Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of August. It is Election Day in the state, and just a reminder, tonight at 8, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio will be bringing you live coverage of the Wisconsin primary election hosted by WPR's Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg. Polling updates, political analysis, results tonight at 8 here on the Ideas Network. The cover story of this month's National Geographic is In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, Rebirth of a Sioux Nation, written by author and journalist Alexandra Fuller and photography by Aaron Huey. The article documents the people who are living with the scars left by the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890, when Oglala men, women, and children were killed by members of the U.S. 7th Cavalry Regiment. Aaron says that everything on the Pine Ridge Reservation is measured before Wounded Knee and after. The article is titled In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. After 150 years of broken promises, the Oglala Lakota people of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota are nurturing their tribal customs, language, and beliefs. A rare, intimate portrait shows their resilience in the face of hardship. Aaron actually, in 2005, was doing a project on poverty in America, and he says he literally found Pine Ridge because it was just another poverty statistic. But when he got there, he got taken in so deep and so fast, before he knew it, the story about poverty in general became a 7-year documentary about the Oglala Lakota of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. It's a beautifully written story, and the pictures, of course, are extremely moving. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both of our guests this hour, and here's how you reach us: 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. So that's what's happening this hour of the program. And we would like to welcome both of our guests. Alexandra, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, a very moving article. You are a beautiful writer, and it sounds like this was a moving experience for you.
I was incredibly lucky to come in on the coattails of Aaron, who had, you know, been on the reservation for so long and had already gone through, I think, some of those very common sort of teeth-cutting experiences of being fresh to a story where you, you know, arrive with sort of prejudices and make a bunch of mistakes and then make very deep connections. So for me, what was really wonderful was I was able to skip, on the whole, the first two stages and go straight to, you know, really being able to connect with people who already trusted Aaron. And I think storytelling and story-taking, which is really what it is so much about being able to be in a position where people trust that you're going to honor their stories.
Yes, and you did. Aaron Huey, as we said, spent 7 years documenting life on the Pine Ridge Reservation. He has many friends on that reservation now, and the pictures are quite extraordinary. Thank you so much, Aaron, for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Can you tell us about, you started by doing, you found Pine Ridge because you were doing a documentary on poverty, but when you found Pine Ridge, you were there documenting Pine Ridge for a number of years. Why?
The poverty thing dropped off pretty quickly. I mean, I have to admit that as a journalist, I went there like all drive-by journalists, knowing absolutely nothing but the statistics on Pine Ridge. I think it was just that families took me so deep, so fast, that I couldn't turn away. I didn't really even know where it was all headed. I mean, for years, I just knew that I couldn't stop telling the story.
You have said, and what did you get from the people you were talking to, concerning 150 years of broken promises, that we can look at what happened in 1890 and judge everything by what happened before 1890 and what happened after 1890. What were the remembrances, and what's the living memory and living life of 1890, Alexandra?
Well, the Wounded Knee isn't the only atrocity at all, by a long shot, and it's not as if it all ended at 1890, but it was such a blow, a sort of body blow to the psyche of the place. And, I have to be careful not to act as if I'm speaking on behalf of the Lakota, because I think that so many of them could point to, the defacing of their Axis Mundi, which is, the carving of the founding fathers of the U.S. on the Black Hills, and the smallpox epidemics that were sent, and so on and so on. But Wounded Knee really has this sort of almost physical resonance if you go there. It's really, really hard not to stand on that mass grave of over 100 years ago and not feel that this somehow isn't all of our stories. And we're all connected to it, whether you have come to the U.S., as I did as an immigrant, and feel as if you have no connection to this past. You realize that's a complete fallacy, that the broken treaties make that history very much living. And the fact that it was such a blatantly brutal, such a blatantly unfair, such a horrible massacre in which women and children were left dead in the snow, I think you can't turn away from it. You can't act as if it was all just part of the Indian Wars and something that we're over and done with.
Mm-hmm. And refresh our memories, what happened in 1890, Aaron?
Oh, boy, the stats are all over the place. But, essentially 300-plus men, women, and children, mostly unarmed, were massacred by a predecessor to the Gatling gun, the Hotchkiss gun, outside of Wounded Knee, South Dakota. And that event essentially ended the Indian Wars. And, again, this, I'm not a historian, and it's difficult for me to place myself as an expert on any of this history. I'm just a photographer, but I also believe that Wounded Knee is not just a thing of the past. There's references to three Wounded Knees: the Wounded Knee in 1890, the takeover in 1973 by the American Indian Movement, and there's also a lot of references to what will be, people believe, will be Wounded Knee 3. And Wounded Knee 3 will be the rise of a new contemporary resistance at the same site. And the people, there are a lot of people that actually still believe that there will be another large confrontation in the future.
There's no doubt that there is enormous poverty, and the pictures are extremely moving. What did both of you see in terms of resilience, Alexandra?
Well, the one thing that really moved and struck me was the spiritual resilience of people, and the way in which that manifests. And I think that I hadn't understood. I think I went out there with the prejudice that, if you weren't sort of the great American culture, then you were just a failed attempt at being American. And what, quote unquote, was wrong with the Lakota, that there was this poverty and dysfunction on the reservation. What I realized when I got there was that the quieter, more powerful, incredible function had to do with the spirituality. But that isn't something, the really deep spirituality isn't something that's easily evident. And the thing that really sort of moved and struck me was I was lucky enough to be witness to a ceremony before two young men were sent on a vision quest. And the one thing that the elder prayed for as we sort of sat in a circle and were about to send these two young men off without food or water for 3 days in the baking, South Dakota sun, was that they come, was that on their vision quest while they're, that's also sort of loose word for what they were doing, but that they realize their own humility, that they realize that they are both as weak as a blade of grass, something that could be crushed underfoot, and as powerful as a blade of grass, something that could feed the body of a great buffalo. And it struck me deeply that it would be very unusual in mainstream American culture to wish for our men to have that level of humility. But what an incredibly empowering prayer for the youth. And that's what I really, I think, was impressed by.
Mm-hmm. You documented in your photographs, and I heard a speech that you gave about the enormous poverty on the reservation, 46 to 48, the life expectancy for men, the infant mortality rate, the 85 to 90% unemployment. Some people will ask, as you say, Aaron, what are these people doing to themselves? It's not really the question we should be asking.
Yeah, you're making a reference to the TED Talk I did, and I really do believe that that is one of the easiest things to say about all of this. When people, I said in my TED Talk, I said the last chapter in any successful genocide is the one in which the oppressor removes his hands and says, "Oh no, look what they're doing to themselves. They're killing themselves while we watch them die." And I think that that's, I don't know what else to say. I think that that's every, I keep getting when I come back from these trips, people, ignorant people will often say, well, why don't they just pick themselves up from the bootstraps, you know, by the bootstraps, this is America, just, you know, get over it. But I don't think you get over that many generations of trauma. You certainly don't get over it when there is no industry and no place to work. And no resources. There's also the misconception that everybody's getting some kind of check from a casino or something. The only casino on Pine Ridge is far from any major highways, and most of the people I see gambling in the casino are residents of the reservation themselves. It's a hard situation, and it's definitely, we're definitely in the last chapters of a genocide with this situation.
Mm. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1980 in U.S. versus the Sioux Nation of Indians upheld an award you document of $17.5 million for the value of the land in 1877, along with 103 years worth of interest. But the Sioux rejected that payment. Why did they do that, Alexandra?
They said the Black Hills are not for sale and their spirituality isn't for sale. And I think that that's, you know, I think one of the sort of really frustrating things and shocking things for me that really set off a kind of tuning fork of horror and deep inside me, I grew up in southern Africa, north of the Limpopo, but I had gone back to document post-apartheid South Africa. And, of course, one of the things you can't ignore when you go into South Africa is this idea of, an apartheid of ethnicity, that everyone is documented with an inch of their blood. And when I went out, onto the reservation, the thing that sort of struck me was that the disempowerment is so complete. The Bureau of Indian Affairs they control all the land and all quote unquote Indian issues, and so there's no autonomy, and the people on the reservation are required to carry a tribal card that documents to within an inch, to within a drop, what their blood group is. So someone might be 7/8 Lakota or 7/16 Lakota, for example. And the moment at which you cease to become Lakota in the eyes of the U.S. government is when your blood group drops below a quarter. And so you're constantly, I think, aware not only of your history but of your difference away from the U.S. And you aren't, you can't have, we, I think it's very hard to have this conversation as if we're on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm. There is so much poverty, which you have documented. You also, Aaron, heard from friends in the Pine Ridge community saying that there are other stories here, and thus you have created the Pine Ridge Community Storytelling Project. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's been one of the hardest parts about this project. I mean, in 7 years, I've had plenty of time to make a lot of mistakes on this story. it's hard to begin with being from the dominant society and coming in and telling the story of a people like this. But I knew going into the story for National Geographic that even given the incredible page count that National Geographic was generous enough to give us, that there was no way, whether we had 38 pages or 100 pages, to tell all of the stories that the people thought represented themselves. And this is the people that have felt so misrepresented by the media for so long. Most stories about Pine Ridge are about poverty, gangs, and violence in a never-ending loop because it's the easiest thing to get. It's the easiest thing to photograph. It's very sensational. But I kept being asked, why can't you guys tell the story of our star basketball player and all our scholars and this huge list? And I knew that there was no way we could tell all the stories that would make the people feel represented. So I spent the last year at Stanford University on a night journalism fellowship that gave me the time and the space to step back from my daily life as a journalist to look at how I could improve journalism and storytelling in my field. And I realized what I wanted to do was to try to finally kind of hand off the baton and allow the Lakota to tell their own story, because it actually is not my story to tell. And I knew... Yeah, this is. I'm sorry. It's been such a long journey. I knew I couldn't do what the people needed me to do. So mm-hmm. I created a platform so they could do it for themselves. And I think it's been incredibly successful. I think right now there are 220 stories that have been loaded to National Geographic. I would guess there'll probably be 500 by the end of the year, completely unedited. This has never been done on this level in journalism, as far as I know. That there's been a embedded, co-launched community storytelling effort like this. You know, this is not some link off to some other site. This is unedited material embedded inside of NationalGeographic.com. It's a pretty special thing.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests this hour. It's the cover story of National Geographic. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen this month's issue. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, Rebirth of a Sioux Nation. Aaron Huey is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, photographer for National Geographic. He has spent 7 years documenting life there, and he's also, as you heard him just talk about, creator of Cowbird. It's Pine Ridge Community Storytelling Project. Also joining us is Alexandra Fuller, an author and journalist. Her article is In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. She wrote the story and spent time, of course, on the reservation as well. We'll welcome phone calls from you. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, our guest argues that we need to become smarter consumers in order to propel us into what he calls the intention economy, one in which demand will drive supply far more directly, efficiently, and compellingly than ever before. And of course, a reminder, today is Election Day in the state of Wisconsin. We'll be bringing you live coverage of the Wisconsin primary election tonight at 8 o'clock. Polling updates, political analysis, results, WPR Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg will be your host tonight at 8 o'clock. All right, to your phone calls, starting with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene. Hi, Eugene, are you there? Well, put him on hold and try him again in a moment. Annie in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, I'd like to tell you my what happened in 1973. During the uprising, my husband and I decided that we lived up on Lake Superior to drive down to the reservation to see what was going on. And the one thing that I remember was the government had purchased all these prefab houses for the Native Americans. And when they brought them there, they just put them on the ground. They didn't have cement slabs. They didn't have hookups for electricity or water. And, you know, I just wonder if people know that our government just throws money at these situations, not to help them, but to quiet them. And that's all I wanted to say, and I'll listen to the rest of the show on the radio. Thank you.
Thanks, Annie, for the call. Alexandra?
That is, I mean, it's a really
I think, a great comment, and it speaks to the idea of aid and sort of charity in general. There's a wonderful quote by an Aboriginal activist from Australia who says, look, if you've come here to help me, don't waste your time. But if you have come here because your liberty is inextricably bound up with mine, then let us work together. And I think back to something that Aaron said and that Aaron taught me very early on in the story is the Lakota, Native Americans in general, are so used to being underrepresented, to having their stories misrepresented. That very simple thing of not asking, what is it you need that is inextricably bound up with your culture so that we could work together? And the problem is the answer is very queasy for the U.S. government, which is that we want our treaties to be honored. We want, you know, our sovereignty to be noticed and respected. And so it's much easier to throw, sort of bad, half-baked ideas at a reservation, dust your hands and walk away, than to sit down and say, okay, let's rectify, let's have a proper recognition of where we went wrong. And I think one of the things that shocked me was that it wasn't until 2010 that the Obama administration finally was the first U.S. government to come forward and make a non-binding apology to Native peoples for the atrocities that had been committed against them. But it was a non-binding apology, and I think that says everything.
Mm-hmm. It took until 2010 for that to happen.
Right, and it was a bizarre apology, too, and very in keeping with the history between the U.S. government and Native people, and that it was buried deep in the Defense Appropriations Bill.
What was the response to that apology, Aaron?
My response? Oh, I don't put that.
No, not your response. What was the response among the Lakota?
I don't know if it really amounted to anything for them. I think that, again, the only thing that really speaks would be like real moves to honor existing treaties, sovereignty. You know, Alexander brought up this idea of sovereignty is a joke. People are not really allowed to do the most basic things that would help them to survive. The story opens up with Alex Whiteplume and a non-THC hemp crop that he was trying to grow because it was the only thing that would really grow in the area of Manderson and Wounded Knee. And that was eradicated 3 years in a row, which really was proof to everybody on that reservation that the people can't make their own decisions. There is no such thing as sovereignty on the reservation. It's a very thin facade.
You write, Alexandra, about the agents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, from the FBI, swarming in helicopters and shutting down that hemp operation.
And I think the thing that where we are really getting things wrong in terms of, you know, the we and them / sort of dichotomy, which I think is always so dangerous in life and in journalism, is that we're assuming a sort of cultural homogeny, that if we lived on the res, we would do X, Y, Z. So there's this fascination with the culture and a sort of desperate, I think, spiritual seeking to parasite off of deep Indian spiritual practices, which we're very moved by. But there isn't, we don't either as the government or people have the ability to honor that our culture is not their culture, that by Lakota culture, Alex Whiteplume, you know, to grow non-intoxicating hemp for, you know, rope and industry would be a way for him to own the ground beneath his feet. Why is that such a threat to the U.S. government, and why is it that at every turn there's grand talk about sovereignty and then very little actual support of that on the ground, both within the system, which is to say the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which with a long history of writing for National Geographic, I don't believe I've ever come across a government institution that was more difficult to speak to, and more sort of obtuse. So I can't imagine what it would be like for someone from the reservation to try and get a hold of the BIA if a journalist from National Geographic has such a hard time.
Thanks, Annie, for the call. Laura in Twin Lakes. Hi.
Hi. I go to Indian Summer every fall. It's about the second week in September at Meyer Festival Park. And I've followed the case of Leonard Peltier over the years. And they have bumper stickers there that says Free Leonard Peltier. Now, he was the Native American who was part of the rebellion, I guess, at Wounded Knee when they stood up to federal officers. But he's been imprisoned, I believe, in Missouri now for many years. I'm wondering what his status is. Is he still okay?
Aaron?
Well, yeah. I was lucky enough to get to talk to Leonard on the phone very briefly during an American Indian Movement march marking the shootout between FBI agents and others outside of Oglala, South Dakota. And, you know, Leonard Peltier is a political prisoner. He'll never be released from jail. Leonard Peltier will never see the light of day, sadly.
I had petitioned to Clinton back when he did a lot of, pardons, that Leonard Peltier be pardoned, but it didn't happen, obviously.
Yeah, I don't think the U.S. government can back down on that one.
Okay.
I don't think they can afford to take that loss, and I think that he will pay the price of being a political prisoner till his death.
I think one of the things that really surprised me, because I think it's not very well documented in mainstream U.S. media, is how much resistance there is and how much anger there is and how much awareness there is around the miscarriage of justice surrounding the arrest of Leonard Peltier and how little is truly known, I think, in mainstream U.S. culture about the fact that there was even an uprising in the early 1970s that resulted in the permanent imprisonment of a Native leader.
You tell the story, when I think of 1973, I now think about the story that you tell, Alexandra, about a 38-year-old woman, Martinez. Can you document her story and how she was personally reminiscing about 1973?
She was such an inspiring woman, Olawan. Thunderhawk Martinez was a friend of Aaron's, actually, who he introduced me to. And she was brave enough and sort of unself-pitying enough to tell me her story that put the history of her people, both sort of past and present, in context. And her parents had been active members of the American Indian Movement, AIM for short. And at one point, I was talking with Olawan. We were sitting at Wounded Knee, where her father is buried. It's a very sacred site. It's a very sort of important thing, and it signals a lot about him that he is buried there. And she sort of dug her thumb into the ground, and she said, "Wounded Knee, this is where the idea of me happened." And she grew up in that resistance. They were sent on survival camps where they were taught hand-to-hand combat and sort of eating off and living off the land, as Aaron said earlier in this interview, Wounded Knee 3 is just around the corner. But like many people on the reservation, the dysfunction also leaked into her life. And she was sexually molested by an uncle when she was young, twice. And like a lot of young people on the reservation, her reaction to that level of pain was an attempt to take her life. And she was going to cut her wrists, and as she was doing so, it was a thundery afternoon, and a great clap of thunder happened overhead, and this was something that again took me a while to get used to on the reservation, but that I missed terribly the moment I broke through that invisible membrane that takes you back to the U.S., was that she believed that it was the thunder god speaking to her, the thunder spirit speaking to her, and telling her that she couldn't take her own life, and so she didn't, and she has grown up to become a youth leader And even that, when you say that, I mean, it's a, by U.S. standards, a very haphazard sort of free version of what we would think a youth leader would look like. But she's an incredibly powerful, a very inspiring woman.
What is the current status? And when you mention Wounded Knee 3, I want you to elaborate on that. What is the current status of the American Indian movement, Aaron?
Oh, boy, I would love to report that it was strong and well, but I think it's pretty scattered. A lot of people that I talk to are afraid of being hurt and killed and imprisoned. There are a lot of strong memories from the 70s of really terrible things happening, murders and disappearances. And I think with the way that the law exists today, we can label almost anybody we want a terrorist and lock them away. And I think that they would be prime targets for that. And I think that they know that. And I think it scares the hell out of them. What was it? Tell me where to go with that. What was the question again about
Wounded Knee 3? What does that mean?
Well, Wounded Knee 3, yeah, I mean, I think that people know that they, to have visibility, they will have to find a way to take back a piece of the media news cycle, and to do that, that will probably eventually have to happen through some form of violent resistance, or at least a resistance that really has the ability to shut things down. I think it would be pretty easy for us to see a kind of Occupy-style situation start to happen on Pine Ridge and beyond. If the people are angry enough, that's in the air. And I think the people are ready for that and have been probably preparing for that for a long time.
Hmm. Todd in Winona. Hi, Todd.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up White Clay, Nebraska. And the problem it causes for the people, the reservation, for the tribal members, Oglala. This is a little tiny town. I mean, it's got something like a dozen people, but it's got four stores licensed by Nebraska, the state, that sell, gosh, I can't remember, something like, I visited it and I protested it. It was, I think they sell something like 4 or 5 million cans of beer. Mm-hmm. A year, like 12,000 cans a day, almost all of which are purchased by people who live on the reservation, because it's only 200 feet from the reservation border. And this is all absolutely against the wishes of the tribal leaders. It's against the tribal law to have alcohol on the reservation. And the state of Nebraska, I mean, if you go there and visit, people are drunk, they're sold beer when they're drunk, they sell to minors. It's a terrible place. And the state makes, I don't know, $500,000 a year, maybe more, in liquor sales tax. So they permit it to continue, even though it's been brought up over and over, and the stores violate the liquor laws.
And you mentioned this in the article as well, Alexandra.
Well, and the so the reservation is dry, which is to say it's illegal to be in possession of alcohol, be under the influence, and yet, you know, as the caller correctly mentions, there's this town that's not even incorporated, which is nothing but liquor stores. And I think this is one of the disconnects. I want to go back to something that Aaron was saying about resistance on the reservation, that there is such a disconnect locally, and some of that has to do with the fact that 80% of families are affected with alcoholism, that there is such poverty, that there are enormous distances on the res, that not many tribal members have vehicles, so if they do, they have to be very careful about how they use fuel, that there's a lack of communication, just a sheer lack of phones on the reservation, so that the ways in which people can come together and when you're fighting such basic things as poverty and alcoholism and form a sort of coherent, powerful resistance, is constantly being undermined. And alcoholism is definitely, again, it's one of those very obvious things that you can see when you go onto the res. It's been very well documented. Unfortunately, it's a big, nasty, horrible wound that stays very much on the surface. And I think it's something that's too easy to talk about that and not talk about the deeper reasons why you know, disaffected communities turn to alcohol and engage in this horrible secular dysfunction that includes, you know, abuse of self and others.
Erin, do you want to comment on this, too? There's a picture in the magazine that you took that that addresses this very issue.
Sure. Yeah, when you it reminds me that when you walk across the border in Nebraska, there's a sign that says "Nebraska, the good life." And then it is a very apocalyptic scene. I remember the first time I took Alexander across the border. There's literally bodies in the streets. It's very surreal. I don't know how the people that work in those stores or own those stories go to sleep at night. It's ugly stuff, and it's hard. I actually didn't really want to photograph it for the story because it's one of the drive-by journalism like highlights. Everybody's got to go shoot white clay and shoot drunk Indians. It's a real easy place to make a crazy picture, and it is. In 30 minutes, I saw three fights. It's a very dangerous place to be. I personally know, I think, 35 people that have all died as a direct result of alcohol abuse of some kind in the 6.5-7 years that I've been there. But it is an important thing to point out. I mean, I don't know what can be done about it. There's, like, a state has the right to sell alcohol. It's a really complex issue because we can't shut down businesses because we don't like what they do, but it's obvious that everyone is taking advantage of this crazy situation where, you know, 100 feet away, the alcohol can't be sold. And so it creates a whole economy around itself. It's actually most of the people, not most, that's an unfair thing to say, a very large percentage of people I know in a couple of villages, their only income is bootlegging. They buy cans for $1. And sell cans for $2 back in their village. And that is actually probably the biggest business on the Indian reservation on Pine Ridge, is the selling of illegal alcohol. That is, when there are no other businesses there beyond a hospital, a couple of fast food places, some administration positions, the question is really, like, what else are people supposed to do? To make a living and to pay their bills. So
I'm not
surprised. I don't fault them for finding ways to come up with money to provide for their family.
And not that this is the best way to go, but it's certainly true in the state of Wisconsin that several reservations have done very well with their casinos. Has there been talk about that at Pine Ridge?
Well, there's nowhere to go with that. They're way off of the main tourist roads.
I see.
They're incredibly isolated. I mean, I think that's one of the things, too, that really is the central issue here. This is not really like the place that these people were supposed to live. This is not the Lakotas. You know, it's one small piece of what used to be their land, but their real land, their spiritual homeland is the Black Hills, and they have the right to an incredible amount of land that would give them the ability to have stores and casinos and mines and anything else that they chose, but they live on a prisoner of war camp called the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and all that's on that reservation really are places to have farms, and that's not really in the tradition of the people. So that land is then leased out to white ranchers for pennies on the dollar. So the one business potential that exists there is not being accessed because it's not who they are. They're not ranchers.
Would you use those words? Those are strong words. They live on a prisoner of war camp, Alexandra.
Yeah, I would. absolutely. And I think the other connection that I would make that's incredibly uncomfortable for people, and I think really makes us not want to engage in this conversation here, either honestly in our history books or among one another's, they are open air prison camps, and yet that doesn't allow for the amount of sort of joy and spirituality and deep connection to the land that is felt there. However, very, very reminiscent of South Africa's tribal homelands, where people were deliberately disconnected from their land, put onto, albeit large areas, but far away from cities, so that there was this ability, like we have here in the States, to say, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And you can be as prescriptive as you like, and we've seen this in South Africa too, and I think it's a shocking model, it's a shocking mirror to hold up, that the experience is so similar between the Xhosa or the Zulu or the Venda people and the Lakota people, that indigenous people disconnected from their land and disconnected from the main engine of the country of invasion leads to this exactly the same kinds of behaviors that we see on the res, the sort of alcoholism, the dysfunction, the disconnect, the inability to make a living on that piece of land, because it generally is land that was quote-unquote given away, shunted away, because it was convenient. It wasn't land that other people wanted. And, you know, the Sioux originally had the Black Hills until gold was discovered there, and then the U.S. government woke up and went, wait a minute, perhaps we don't want to give that away, and quickly reclaimed it. So, I think we have to be very honest about the history, and I think that we also need to be honest about the fact that 120 years isn't terribly long ago, that this is history we can reach back and touch, and that it still has a direct impact on people today, and that the murder of their leaders, such as Crazy Horse, and the imprisonment of their modern leaders, such as Leonard Peltier, lead to a continuing oppression. And I cannot imagine another ethnic group in this country who could be treated in this fashion and there be so little knowledge of it in mainstream American media.
In the spirit of Crazy Horse, Rebirth of a Sioux Nation, the creators of the article that is the cover story of this month's National Geographic are with us this hour. Alexandra Fuller, author and journalist, she wrote the story and spent time on the reservation. Aaron Huey, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, photographer for National Geographic, he has been covering this story and was captivated by this story and deeply moved by this story for the past 7 years. Our number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Harry in Madison, hi.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having the courage to do this program. I have 3 points to make. One is, why does the media ignore the Indian reservations? I don't see very much news at any time in the many, many years that I've been here of any coverage of what's happening in the Indian reservation in a regular news cycle. The second thing I want to ask is that what can be done to change the situation? Can the Indian reservations establish any kind of relationship with any foreign power, like, say, China, that could help them? Or is this situation destined to continue like this forever? What would the guests suggest that can be done?
Thank you for the call. Do you want to start, Aaron?
So what can be done? I get asked that question so much ever since I did my TED Talk. And it was easy for me in the TED Talk because I just said exactly what the people wanted me to say. It wasn't even really my idea or what I think is realistic. But if I continue to be a megaphone for the people, what I would say is give them all the land back, which is completely unrealistic, but it doesn't really matter. That's what the people want. But what can be done, I think there are many shades of sovereignty. There are many shades of of giving back. The people could have more rights over control of national parks and forests and sacred sites within their treaty territories. That doesn't mean that every white family with a house within the Fort Laramie 1868 treaty would have to have their house removed. But there are some basic rights, I think, that the people would like to have. Like I said, there are no resources really on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, but in their treaty lands, there are literally trillions and trillions of dollars of resources and jobs and industry and highways where they could have a way to take care of themselves and to plot a new future. So that's one thing that could be done. Why there's no media, I think it's just too difficult for us to look at. I mean, I think in South Dakota there's plenty of media about Pine Ridge, but it's all a lot of it's incredibly racist. And a lot of it is about the most obvious elements, alcoholism, violence, and that really turns people off. And I think people just don't really have the stomach to look at what the story really is. So I think that's why there's no real media. And that's why I'm really proud that National Geographic really took this the direction they did. This is not an easy piece to do for any magazine, and to run it as a story this large with a cover and tell that story to the world is incredibly brave. National Geographic.
Alexander, could you respond to that as well?
I think that the instinct for a lot of journalists is to either romanticize or to bring out the sort of demonic side of what's going on. The sort of drive-by journalism that Aaron alludes to, where you go to a powwow or you go to these amazing long-distance rides that the Lakota engage in, these horseback rides, which are just phenomenal to witness and engage in. And those are the quick, easy stories. But the deeper stories that have to do with what's really going on with the Lakota require 7 years of someone's life. And the real courage of what Aaron did was he went out there without a contract, without any guarantee his pictures were going to be anywhere, and he just did that rarest of thing, which is that he just kept following his soul. He kept thinking, there's something here that needs to be told. Now, most people in our culture don't take that risk. It's expensive to
go out there.
You're leaving your family. You're really jumping away from all the securities that we are raised to believe, sensible contribution to your, retirement fund. And Aaron didn't do that. And that was really amazing. And that's why the story got told, really. And also, I think prescriptions are really tricky. Aaron talks about sovereignty, but we have to reach across history back to recognition and restitution. We can't just talk about casinos and things that we think might work. There needs to be a way that the Lakota can engage in their own economy based on their culture, their spirituality. One of the things that Alex Whitecomb said to me is, one of the reasons you're going to have a hard time telling the story is that the English language doesn't even begin to connect to our spirituality unless you can speak in the Lakota language and sort of understand how circular and spiritual our language is, how it connects us to our ancestors, to our spirits, to our land, you can't begin to tell the story. So already, from the very first word that I put on the page, my story was diminished by incredible power of, 100, by the power of language. And so even when we do tell the stories about the reservation, we're doing it with one hand tied behind our backs, with a blindfold of history across our eyes, and with our mouths gagged, really.
We have time for one more call. Jackie in Drummond, hi.
I'll make this really quick. Years ago, I was on a bicycle trip on the Mickelson bike trail, and that was where they're building the Crazy Horse. And I was just kind of taken back, at the blasting and the defamation of of this area. And I stopped to talk to an Indian chief, and he really hit home with me. He said, see over there, Mount Rushmore, there would be no need for Crazy Horse if we had our land and there was no Mount Rushmore. And that was a poignant story that has just left me thinking and wondering why Mount Rushmore exists.
We have about 30 seconds. Aaron?
Yeah, Mount Rushmore. I mean, that's in the Cowbird collection that we talked about briefly. One of the first stories in that collection is a story a high school student tells about a picture of Mount Rushmore and about that desecration of a sacred monument. And also a quick correction, I did not invent Cowbird. I was the bridge between the two. That was created by an internet super genius named Jonathan Harris. But you can see stories about what the people really think about the Black Hills, Mount Rushmore, on this National Geographic Community Storytelling Project.
Thank you both so much for being with us. It is such a moving story, and congratulations to National Geographic for giving it such prominence as well. And thanks to you, Aaron. It wouldn't exist if it weren't for what you've done. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Our guest this hour, Aaron Huey, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, photographer, and he has worked on this project for 7 years for National Geographic. Alexandra Fuller, author and journalist, her article in The Shadow of Wounded Knee is the cover story in the August issue of National Geographic. We thank them both so much for being with us, and thanks. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your calls. You can leave messages on our Facebook page if you'd like to do that. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers produced this program. Thanks to both of them. We will continue our Tuesday morning conversation in just a few moments after the news.